Now, there's another route that we need to think about, and that's the route from naturalism to nihilism. And here I want to bring in Sayer's material in his chapters on naturalism and nihilism. He finds three bridges between naturalism and nihilism. The first is the chance and necessity problem, that this dehumanizes and impersonalizes human beings. Remember, this is a closed system of cause and effect. There's no transcendent creator or designer. The universe is just there. It's a brute fact. Human beings appeared on the scene as if their number came up in a Monte Carlo game, as Jacques Monod put it in his book, Chance and Necessity. So the human person can be exhaustively explained in terms of natural laws, material states, and chance. So material states, not immaterial states, it's naturalism or physicalism of some sort. Natural law, which is impersonal, it just popped into existence at the Big Bang, and chance. But don't think that chance is the foundation for freedom. It's not. Because chance, on this worldview, is just happenstance. It's not a zone for purposeful activity. It's just that some things can't be explained according to natural law. Maybe they will be at a later time, or maybe some things will just happen without antecedently sufficient states. But that's just as meaningless as impersonal law. Yes? Mm-hmm. Well, it depends on how people want to cash it out. I mean, R.C. Sproul has a good book about that, about the concept of chance. I can't think of the title of it right now. I think it's called Not a Chance. And people say, well, you explain it by chance. Well, really, chance can't explain anything. It means there's no explanation. It just happened. So what you can't explain by natural law and matter, and some people think you can explain all of it that way. They're looking for this final theory that supposedly explains everything naturalistically. But if something can't be, it's chance. But that is not a foundation for meaning or freedom. It's mere happenstance. It's mere fortuity. Now, people who reflect on this realize that that makes us just, at best, sort of fluky machines. I say fluky to build in the chance. Okay? We're machines, we're material, we're the result of impersonal natural laws that just popped into existence for no reason, with no cause. And maybe there are a few quantum flukes once in a while. But we're just fluky machines, you know, funky, fluky machines. That's it. Now, if that's the case, and we're not designed, and we don't have an immaterial substance, then this leads to dehumanization and to the impersonalization of human beings. So people start treating each other that way. For instance, Peter Singer has been a great advocate of completely overthrowing the Judeo-Christian view that human beings are more important than other living things. He wants to desacralize human life. Why? He's an atheist. He says attributing any moral or spiritual significance to humans above animals is just a hangover from Christian theism. So the only thing that counts is states of pleasure and pain. So an unborn baboon can have more moral worth than a retarded born child, because it's not defective. And it has more capacity for pleasure, supposedly. Now, Singer claims to be utilitarian and not a nihilist, but I think you can see how this perspective on the human person really dehumanizes people. Questions or comments there? Now, you can say, well, but I have my throb. Sure. Metaphysically, cosmically, I'm a funky, fluky machine and nothing else, but I have my throb, the Paul Kurtz throb. Right? Dig it. Paul Kurtz throb. Big deal. The whole thing is just a brute fact, or a collection of brute facts. Does your throb correlate to anything objectively real and significant and lasting in the universe? No. Because when it goes away, there's nothing left. And when you go away, you dissolve into your component parts. Another one we've really dealt with previously is the great cloud of unknowing. These are bridges from naturalism to nihilism. See, people want to maintain naturalism, which is the reigning worldview of the academy. I think you realize that if you've been to a secular school. Naturalism is presupposed in all the disciplines, despite its tremendous philosophical problems. It's just the de facto worldview. It's supposed to be the scientific, the rational, the objective way of approaching things. But you have the problem as well of knowledge. We dealt with that, I believe, last time. Why should you trust your cognitive equipment if they were not designed to know anything? If we are simply the products of that which has survived through this struggle for existence, which went from non-life to life to sentience to us, the important thing, as Patricia Churchland puts it, is getting your body parts in the right place to reproduce, not knowing truth, not rationality. I mean, that might play some role, but it need not play a leading role, and it may not play any distinctive role. Excuse me, because the worldview makes rationality a latecomer in the universe. Because the rational comes out of the non-rational. All right, you with me on that? Sentience comes out of non-sentience. A sense of morality comes out of amorality. So you cannot relate morality or knowledge or rationality to anything larger than this latecomer in the universe, which came about through natural law and chance and matter. That's it. You also have the is and the ought problem. If you have no transcendent moral law above the material, then you can describe what is, you can describe how animals interact, you can describe how humans interact anthropologically, sociologically, psychologically, but how do you derive an ought statement or a descriptive statement that's normative? One ought not torture the innocent for pleasure. Torturing the innocent for pleasure is always morally wrong. Those kinds of statements. How do you derive that statement if you merely have natural properties to select from? Becomes very difficult to do. In fact, there are some thinkers that live up to this. One of them is Steven Pinker. Pinker believes we're nothing basically but meat machines. But he says this, ethical theory requires idealizations like free, sentient, rational, equivalent agents whose behavior is uncaused. And yet the world, as seen by science, does not have uncaused events. He's saying basically, to describe us in terms of natural law and chance eliminates human agency. But we need a sense of human agency for all these things he just mentioned. And he says, a human being is simultaneously a machine and a sentient free agent, depending on the purposes of the discussion. Or, as he also put it, depending on whether we are playing the science game or the ethics game. So the ethics game, I'm taking this from Nancy Piercy's new book, Total Truth. The ethics game is where? In the upper story. Human beings have moral freedom and dignity. The science game, humans are data processing machines. Now, if you're going to be consistent, you'd have to say that humans are data processing machines, period, full stop, given naturalism. See, what you're trying to do is sneak in a theistic concept of agency into naturalism, where it does not fit. It's what Van Til called living on borrowed capital, intellectual borrowed capital. You're taking a Christian sense of agency and ethics and meaning, and importing it into a worldview where it's an alien. It does not fit. And Pinker and others realize it doesn't fit, so they sort of just throw up their hands. Well, given science, given empirical knowledge, given material states of affairs, we have to say we're nothing but computational machines, no room for ethics, no room for agency, no room for mind. But we still have to play the ethics game for things like sentencing criminals, law codes, condemning terrorists, maybe. Yeah.
Do they make the argument that that's just part of the natural evolution of the machine in terms of self-preservation and things like that? That's where those things come from?
Well, some people try to say that every moral scruple that we have is somehow rooted in our evolutionary past. Pinker's a great advocate of that. But you see, you're reducing it to instinct. Now, instinct is a very different thing than a conscience. C.S. Lewis argues this beautifully in The Abolition of Man. The conscience is what selects between instincts. Have you ever been in a situation where you feel pulled in both directions? The instinct doesn't decide. The conscience decides which direction to go in. Now, naturalism has a very difficult time accounting for conscience. It can account for instinct in animals to some degree. But when you talk about evaluating states of affairs morally, that's more than instinct. But the instinct is really all they have at their disposal. So someone like Pinker, as I mentioned, I think last time, argued that when that young woman gave birth in a restroom to a baby and killed the baby and then went out and finished going to her prom, that she was doing something similar to what's done in the animal world when mothers give birth to offspring that may not have a very good chance to survive. Sometimes they kill them. So he was trying to explain it in terms of instinct. But then he pulls back and he goes into the upper story. See? It's like, here's the science story, and now I get up here and I'll get up on the moral story, which is, I can't condone it. But then he kind of plays it halfway and says, but we shouldn't call it murder. Pinker, which way is it? Do you have a moral worldview that can condemn this or not? I think he's trying to play both sides against the middle. Given his evolutionary psychology, he can't condemn it. Given his humanity, made in the image and likeness of God, even though he denies it, he has a sense of conscience that calls him to at least say something bad about this behavior. Right? So you have the is and the ought problem. How do you derive an ought from a strictly material state of affairs? Or even, let's say, if you're a dualist who's also a naturalist, how do you describe an ought? How do you find a higher moral authority if all we have are human beings in the universe, where all kinds of things happen? How do you evaluate? How do you separate the wheat from the chaff? All right, questions or comments on the bridges from naturalism to nihilism? Now, of course, if any of our arguments work, design arguments work, cosmological arguments work, mind arguments work, then this viewpoint, naturalism, is already sunk. So you can sink naturalism through positive apologetics, design arguments, mind arguments, cosmological arguments, moral arguments, religious experience arguments. But another thing you can do is take naturalism as a standing worldview and then press it to its conclusion. Oftentimes, naturalists live straddled in two worlds. The world that has no meaning, no purpose, no value, naturalism, which tends toward nihilism, and in the world of Christian theism, where you have objective moral meaning and purpose. And what you need to do, and Schaeffer was a great master of this, is press people to the logic of their presuppositions. And at that point, they either have to go with the logic of their own assumptions, their own presuppositions, or they have to move towards a Christian view that will make sense. I mean, how do you really conserve a strong sense of moral responsibility in a naturalistic worldview? Or how do you conserve the notion that the universe is basically intelligible and humans can know it through scientific experimentation and through other things? Or how do you conserve the idea of there being moral truths that are not dependent on human states of mind? Well, you've got to move into some kind of a theism. But if you don't, then you should be consistent with your own worldview. And the more consistent you are with a non-Christian worldview, the more difficult and unlivable it becomes. So in some cases, and Schaefer lays this out so nicely in The God Who Is There, in some cases, I think, for people to come to Christ and come to Christ clean, knowing what it means and knowing who they are before God, they must become miserable. They must become disgusted and bothered by their own worldview. And if you try to pull them into the Christian understanding too quickly, it may be a false conversion. They may not understand how lost they are. Not just morally lost before a holy God, being a sinner before God, but that they don't know who they are. They're like cosmic orphans. I mean, at one level, they know God is there. Romans 1 speaks to that. But they're trying to suppress that truth and take a few truths from Christianity about moral meaning, but then put it in a naturalistic worldview. When you say, look, that's an unstable combination. So you want to force people to the logic of their assumptions, the logic of their presuppositions. They either have to become, I think in terms of naturalism, nihilists, or they have to look for another worldview. Now, part of the problem with nihilism is that it is very difficult to affirm coherently. Now, nihilism has different forms, but it basically believes that there is nothing of value. Or put it this way, everything is meaningless. So there's no moral meaning, there's no aesthetic meaning, there's no design or purpose or significance to life. You know, the Shakespeare line, a tale told by an idiot full of sound and fury signifying nothing. So can someone live that way consistently? Some people will claim to be nihilists. They want to destroy. There was a punk band in the 80s, I forgot, I think it was the Sex Pistols, had a lyric that said, I don't know what I want, I don't know what I want, but I do know one thing I want, and that's to destroy. I think it was a song called God Save the Queen. Not that I'm a big expert on punk music, but I remember reading that somewhere. Some of you may be. I want to destroy. So there's nothing of any value, so I want to bring everything down. But even there, there's kind of an affirmation of something to do, something to live for, something to make music for. So people act according to what they value. They do things in life. They put one foot in front of the other. They engage in projects. But none of it would have any justification. It would all be random. It would all be arbitrary because you couldn't choose one path over another. Because it's nihilism. It's nothingism. There's no justification for anything. Everything is up for grabs. Now, nihilists are still human beings. And see, this is what we have going for us in apologetics, that people remain human beings in God's universe even when they deny those facts. So what we want to try to do with a nihilist is to say, no, there are some things that you value. Maybe your family, maybe your friends, maybe certain types of art. You value more than other forms of art, but you really couldn't make the evaluation anything objective or anything you could communicate to someone else. You know, one nihilist is talking to another. You really should like this piece of art. I mean, come on. There's no way it could work because everything is meaningless. Now, if you really want to exegete it in terms of semantics and meaning, semantical meaning and syntactical meaning, get rid of our helpful apologetic figures here. Just look at this statement for a minute. Everything is meaningless. I'll just put M. Everything is meaningless. Let's call that statement M. Philosophically exegete that for me. Someone's saying this, maybe screaming it in a song. What do you think of that statement? It's meaningless. If it abides by its truth conditions, everything is meaningless, so the statement is meaningless, so it cannot convey truth or meaning. So it cannot be an affirmative statement about reality if it's true. You know, this is the deep kind of nihilism where cognitively nothing is justified, morally nothing is justified, axiologically nothing is justified, nothing is justified. Everything is up for grabs. That's impossible to communicate that. Now, someone might say, well, through some fluke, we have semantic and syntactical meaning. We can communicate with each other. But morally, anything goes. You can't justify any moral claim. Well, you just have to try to use counterarguments and counterexamples. Now, you may fail. I mean, I remember a time pretty vividly where I gave a talk against moral relativism at a university in, I don't remember where it was, I remember the classroom, I think it was Canada. And I gave a talk on moral relativism, and the professor and I was a guest speaker when I was with Probe Ministries. I was talking to a young man afterwards, and we're trying to come up with propositions that he would consider morally wrong. So I said, all right, how about this one? Because he said, I'm a complete relativist, there's nothing true morally. I used the old one, it's always wrong to torture the innocent for pleasure. And he goes, no, that's not universally wrong. And the professor just about blew her stack. She started yelling at the guy, you know that that's wrong. Come on, you're faking it. You know that that's wrong. Well, what can you do at that point? Come up with other counterexamples? Just hope the person realizes that he was bluffing? I don't know what you can do at that point. If you give those kind of examples and people still stick with it, you pray for them, I suppose. So the argument is that naturalism leads to nihilism. Nihilism is a very difficult position to consistently affirm and live out. Now, naturalism is shot if any of the positive apologetic arguments that we have already used works. But you can argue against naturalism and, as it were, kind of bracket the natural theology and just say, look at this worldview. Can you conserve knowledge? Can you conserve meaning? Can you conserve morality given this worldview? Or does it lead to nihilism? And can you live with nihilism? Can you advocate nihilism? You with me on this? It's a very powerful way to argue. Now, we've already talked about some of the things. Well, I want to bring up a few more other things. But we've talked about the argument from damnation. This is where you might shock a nihilist, is try to give instances of objective value that they will relate to. Sometimes extremely evil occurrences can trigger a person's sense of moral outrage. And you need to know the person maybe to use this effectively and skillfully. So you give a scenario and you say, what's your reaction to that? And if they condemn it in very strong terms, even in the terms of damnation, as it were, someone like that deserves to be damned, then you're really dealing with a transcendent moral standard. And you're also dealing with a providential sense of justice. People like that deserve more than they will get in this life. They deserve a fuller punishment than what we can provide. Well, if so, you're not a nihilist. Now, some people have argued that science proves nihilism because science has proven that anything that is knowable only through scientific procedures. Values are not knowable through scientific procedures. Therefore, there are no objective values. Therefore, nihilism is true. The problems with that statement are manifold. But one is that this trades on a concept of science called scientism, which is that, we'll come back to this later, that science is the only way to know anything. Basically, if it's not empirically confirmable, or if it's not some kind of a tautology or a necessary truth, it can't be justified. Now, again, let's try a self-reference test. Unless something is empirically observable, either directly or indirectly, or is a necessary truth, it can't be knowable. Do a self-reference on that criterion, that twofold criterion. Is it necessarily true? Such as a triangle has three sides, or 2 + 2 = 4? No. Is it empirically verifiable? No. So it's necessarily false. It has no chance of being true. It's as false as triangles have four sides. It's as false as 2 + 2 = 5. It cannot be true. It's false in every possible world. It's not just a little wrong. It's as wrong as you can get. Because a statement has to abide by its own truth conditions. If a statement is self-refuting, it cannot be true. It must be false. So much for that argument. Nihilism and persuasion I've really already hinted at that one. When you try to persuade someone to do something because it's right, or you persuade someone to value something because it's good or beautiful or true, you're not in the world of nihilism. Nihilism is the world of power and propaganda and manipulation. It's not the world of giving reasons to explain states of affairs or persuading people through the use of evidence. And we've already talked about livability. Questions or comments on this? Naturalism to nihilism. Yes? Yeah, that's good. Sometimes you have to do sort of existential apologetics. I mean, J.P. Moreland did that as well once, where he was talking to some person in a dorm who gave this either relativism or nihilism, and then he took the guy's boombox and walked out the door with it. He said, "What are you doing?" "Well, I want it. You know, I like to play religious music, and this is a really good one, and I want to use it." And you can't say it's wrong. You know, you kind of go for the gut with people. Now, what you want to do is incorporate that gut feeling into a worldview that makes sense of their gut. Right? So within bounds, and you have to be careful with these kind of things, within bounds, that kind of a procedure may just open up people's eyes to the folly of this. Okay? Anything else on nihilism? Have you ever encountered nihilists, nihilistic art, literature? You know, there are levels of nihilism. There's sort of the 1950s, 60s French existential kind of anguished nihilism. But there's really a kind of an American postmodern nihilism as well, which is not anguished, which is really not bothered, which is pretty stupefied, pretty anesthetized, and pretty happy playing with as many toys as possible for as long as we can. But when you press it, it's still nihilism. You might be more entertained, and you're not in despair or distress over it. But if you try to give any justification for human life or for meaning or for value, it's gone. It's not there. It's missing. And I think part of what we need to do is just something Schaefer talked about, is take the roof off of people's worldviews and let the acids of reality fall on their worldview. And sometimes that happens in moments of crisis. National crisis, personal crisis, terminal illness, death of a friend, death of a family member, profound disappointments, flunking the bar exam, things like that. Sometimes that's a moment, kind of a worldview moment for people, where they realize that they really have nothing to live for the way they now are. They've been entertaining themselves, they've been stupefying themselves, they've been distracting and diverting themselves maybe for decades. And now, it's sort of, is this all there is? That kind of a moment. That's a tremendous moment to be there as a friend and to suggest that you're right. The way you're living life doesn't have a lot of meaning, but there is an objective meaning that you can discern and understand, and I can explain to you, someone else can explain to you, that will give you an entirely different way to live. And it's not just a new style to try out. It's not another postmodern diversion. It's true. It's rational. It makes sense. And it demands your all. But Christ gave his all for you.